I need the dirty way you should listen to it.
Yeah. So there isn't an accumulative process. Now, but again, you mentioned mainly the Russian thinkers. Now, were you attracted by them also because of your command of length of Russian?
Yes, certain. Certain. I like reading Russian for its own sake. I just write, it's a language I knew, I didn't have many people to talk to. It says, I give me, so to speak, in some sense of romantic nostalgia when I read it at all. And I used to talk to people, of course, during the war. I met more Russian speakers than I ever met in England. Barton Rachmilevich and one other person, well, my parents occasionally, I suppose, one other person, Michael Bilibin, who was at school with me, was the son of a famous Russian painter. He knew how to talk Russian to him, because he was a Russian. Apart from that, it always had an appeal to me of a distant country in which I was born, and but which I obviously had certain romantic, probably visions of pre-revolution in Russia. No doubt. But it is because I became addicted to Herz and Belinsky that I abandoned philosophy. That's what made it. My idea that history of ideas, what I wanted, was induced by them. Plus Helvetius and all this 18th century stuff, and Saint-Simon, Fourier, all the stuff I had to read for the sake of Marx. All these writers interested me more than Marx did.
So, because then, after the war, did you decide to abandon philosophy? When was it?
I'll tell you exactly when.
There is a story about the...
Correct. It's correct. It's exactly what happened. During the war, I used to talk about philosophy to Professor Quine, another famous philosopher who was... He was in the Navy Department, in the intelligence, in Washington. I'd met him somewhere, and we used to have lunch once in 3 months and talk about philosophy. At that time, it was just straight philosophy, logic, that kind of thing. I read William James, yes. But that's about all. I never thought I'd have a good... I read a man called C.I. Lewis, whom I was deeply impressed by, and Austin and I had a class on him in Oxford, and it was the first class on a modern philosopher had anyone held in Oxford in history. And that made an impression too, but that had nothing to do with the history of ideas. That was really was straightforward philosophy. Absolutely. He was more or less the last pragmatist. Any one of the symbolic logicians, he was a mathematical logician by training. He taught Quine. And so on, you see. Anyway, that has nothing to do with the other thing. No, the story is true. It sounds mystical, but it's true. What happened is this. I knew there was a man called Schaeffer. Schaeffer was a Jew who was one of the isolated mathematical logicians in the world. There were very few. Symbolic logic, mathematical logic. In 1900, there was Russell, there was Frege, there was Peano in Italy. Whitehead took some interest. Schaeffer was one of very few people trained by the same famous American pragmatist, contemporary of William James and Santayana and all these people, and so on. Forgotten his name. Quite well known. Never mind. Anyhow, it was his pupil. And then he produced a famous thing called the stroke function. The stroke function knocked out certain parts of Principia Mathematica. It was printed, I can't remember when it was published, 15 or 16. So he was famous for that. Now, Felix Frankfurter mentioned to me that there was a man called Schaeffer, and I said, if I go to Harvard, which I intend to do anyway, during the war, to visit somebody, I'd quite like to meet him. He said, oh yes, I know him very well. He's a very nice man, He is a Jew from the Boston ghetto, roughly, called Harry Schaeffer. He really had a rather unhappy life. He was married to a prostitute. She, unlike all the prostitutes of the story, she was not golden-hearted, but extremely nasty. She used to stand in the middle of Harvard Yard, complained her husband didn't give her enough money. President Lowell was very anti-Semitic, very snobbish anyway. Never saw them, never invited them. I mean, ostracized them. The first man who rescued him was Whitehead. When he came to Harvard, he rescued him and extracted him. No. No, he was, well, no, not quite. He was younger. But I can't remember why he went to America. He must have gone, well, in the 30s. Schaeffer was already a fully functioning academic. He may not have been a professor. And so, no, but he realized that Schaeffer was very gifted, a very nice woman, more or less rehabilitated him. He was socially very depressed. And so, when I went to Harvard, Felix Frankfurter wrote, gave me a letter to Schaeffer. Schaeffer asked me to lunch. No, because he mentioned him in the course of conversation. And I said, ah, Schaeffer, I know that is. I'd rather like to meet him. Simply because a famous, to me, famous name, because it was known that Russell, you see, had deep respect for him. That I knew, you see. So here was somebody interesting. I didn't know he was a Jew. I mean, I thought he might be, but anyway, I was going to Harvard, who could I see there? So, I was going to see Salvemini, who was an Italian historian. I was going to see the biographer of William James, one or two people, but Schaeffer was a name to me for some reason. I think Lewis was a pupil of Schaeffer's, might have been. Anyhow, certainly a friend and colleague, respectful towards him. Well, Schaeffer asked me to lunch at the faculty club. I realized when I saw him that everybody looked at him like an anchorite had come from the desert. People were respectful but astonished to see him. He never appeared in public. He was a sort of man who lived in a little cabin by himself. People bowed but were rather astonished to see him. He was very nice. And what he said to me was this. We talked about philosophy. And he said, you know, there are only two subjects in philosophy in which progress is made. One is logic, my subject, he said, where certain new methods knock out the older methods, as in mathematics. To be a good mathematician, you don't need to know the history of mathematics. All you need to know are the weapons which we use now. Then there is psychology, but that's an empirical subject, not really philosophy anymore. Apart from that, he said, philosophy is not a progressive subject. It's not cumulative. Nobody can talk about a learned, somebody who's an ethical scholar. Nobody says somebody learned in epistemology. History of philosophy is, of course, well, that's like history of furniture, isn't it? History of anything is history. And he said, the thing is, new problems arise, and people try and solve them. But you can't say, we've solved this problem forever, no more. That's been done, now we go forward. It's not progressive. And I said, if I knew that my studies in logic would lead to people like Carnap and people like Eyre, I would never have written. I think they've ruined philosophy. The idea that philosophy consists of little black marks on paper, he said, which can be exchanged for each other in accordance with certain rigid rules, is the death of thought. He spoke very vehemently against the current school, you see, of the predominant, in some circles, of, so to speak, logical positivism. He said philosophy is a deep, great subject, and so on, you see, which White understands, which I take quite a different view of, but these people are just, he said, mechanics. These people are not thinkers at all, in my sense. And he went on like this. All right. And I was surprised, amused, impressed. He was this remarkable man, saying all these things. That was all. I never saw him again. This must have happened in 1944. Then it's quite correct, then I had to fly to England, as it were, officially. Well, it's not that so much. I had to fly from Montreal in a bomber. It was not pressurized. They weren't in those days, 44. It was dark, and so we couldn't read. It was pressurized, so we had to have oxygen. So one couldn't sleep, because they were afraid that one might, fall on one's pipe, suffocate. So I was forced for something like 9 hours, which is what it took, to think. It's a very painful process. Descartes says somewhere that for a purpose of intensive thought, 4 minutes is enough. In the course of these thoughts, I began thinking about Schaeffer and philosophy. And I suddenly came to the, almost to me, surprising conclusion. I'm not addicted to long thoughts about myself. But on this occasion, I couldn't help it. That I really wasn't terribly anxious to know the answers to the philosophical questions which I had to deal with professionally. Freedom of the will, yes. But I thought about that nothing very new had been said since the Greeks. Maybe one or two other things, but broadly. I was not gripped. I was quite good at doing it. I taught pupils, I read the literature, I took part in discussions. I wasn't too bad at it. I mean, I was competent. I read articles. I was quite a competent professional. Often not particularly notable. I mean, not in the front rank in any way. But still, I was all right. I mean, up to the mark. Up to what Oxford calls fellowship standard. That's about as far as I went. But it wasn't what gripped me. But what did grip me was Belinsky, Herzen, Helvetius, Holbach, Plekhanov, and to some extent even Marx, and that sort of thing. And so when I came to England, I went to Oxford. First I registered myself in London and did whatever I was supposed to do in the Foreign Office, to which I by that time belonged. Then I went to Oxford, and I announced to my astonished colleagues, New College, that I wished to stop doing philosophy, wished to devote myself to these two ideas. And could my fellowship be extended to that? They said, certainly not. We don't have a fellowship in the subject. After the war, there will be a great many people coming back. You must go on teaching. I mean, we can't start electing. I mean, we can elect a new fellow, but in that case, you'll have to go. So faced with this ultimatum, and as I was quite common, I said, all right, I'll go on for a bit anyway, see what happens. And so I went on teaching philosophy quite nicely from 46 onwards. But by this time, I began teaching Russian ideas on the side. I had a little class about the history of Russian revolutionary ideas in the 19th century, to which came people, were the few people who did the Russian courses in Oxford, like Hingley.
You didn't take the translation?
What?
You didn't translate?
No. I did it entirely. I just talked. I assumed they did, because they read and they written. I didn't ask what they read. We simply discussed the work, but 8 people came, maybe 10, certainly not more. And I had little classes in New College, to which I then belonged, which I enjoyed very much. And they did quite. Nobody else was remotely interested in that in Oxford. In America, yes. Then, but I went on teaching philosophy, lecturing on Berkeley, Hume, Locke, all that, Kant, the whole thing. I mean, we see absolutely quite solidly. And by 19... Then I was kept, I think George Kennan recommended me to Harvard, and I went to Harvard in 49. And by this time I had written an article on Russia in 1848, which I contributed to some Slavic journal. internal Slavic studies. I'd written something else on Russia too. And also I'd been to the Soviet Union meanwhile. And I bought a lot of books. So I also wrote a broadcast on Belinsky and a broadcast on Plekhanov after some centenary of his birth. And generally became involved in that kind of thing. Yes, yes. That wasn't yes, but people didn't particularly talk to me about that. And then I was invited to Harvard to take part in two things, the Russian Research Center and area studies in Russian 19th century thought. There was a real clientele. At Harvard, it was only a graduate class, but 70 people came. There I properly lectured properly from the beginning to the end. I began with the 18th century, went right through, prepared lectures very carefully on all the Russian thinkers, history of Russian social and political thought as such, which I greatly enjoyed, which would grip me much more than philosophy had done. And I realized this was really my thing. And then when I came back to Oxford, which must have been in the summer of 49, late summer, I mean autumn, 49, I talked to John Foster, I think, who was a colleague of mine at All Souls, saying, really, I wanted to be very much nice if I could come back to All Souls and devote myself to this subject. Now, the warden of All Souls at that time was Humphrey Sumner, who was a Russian historian, who didn't at all approve of me before the war, thought I was a chatterbox. I was just a friend of Maurice Barra and various Oxford wits, and I wasted my time, wasted other people's time, looked on me with considerable disapproval. But because my dispatches during the war in Washington had become quite well known, because all this sort of people who died at All Souls and fellows of All Souls spoke, began speaking about me for purely extraneous reasons and very bad reasons and contemptible reasons, really, you see. He became much more affable to me because it was evident that I'd made a name for myself in what he did respect, which is, politics and, so to speak, English political life and serious subjects, foreign affairs, that he thought was all right. His attitude towards me changed. He didn't like me, but he began to think me worth thinking about. And so Dr. Franz Foster talked to him, and so in the end he suddenly offered me a fellowship in All Souls, research fellowship, for this purpose. Also I'd written a book on Karl Marx before the war, which showed that I was capable of some research and actually writing and so on. I wasn't totally idle and so on. So then I went back to All Souls in 1950 and became professionally interested in these matters. I didn't do much work, it's true, but still I did potter around history ideas. That's when I produced an essay on Russian, on political ideas of the 20th century. All these things go into that book, and on historical inability, yes, and John Stuart Mill, and all that. That happened during the 50s. Yes. Well, halfway through, I mean, 50 to 55, 6. That sort of period.
Before you published your well-known articles or papers, like historical inevitabilities and others, didn't your friend, old philosopher friends, try to deter you?
No.
That you are adventurous?
No. Not at all. No. Nobody thought of me as good enough philosopher to persuade to remain in the subject. On the contrary, very unflattering. Very unflattering. No. No effort was made to tell me not to go off these paths. On the contrary, not at all. Not at all. If I wanted to do that, I wanted to do that. I left New College and went back to All Souls. Nobody tried to persuade me of anything. In that sense, I don't think anybody in Oxford has ever tried to persuade anybody to do this rather than that, to my knowledge. Indeed.
Now, coming back to Schaeffer, In this case, I believe that had you not met Chapter, still you would have.
Of course. It's a somewhat Marxist point on your part, but nevertheless. Nevertheless, I think it's quite right to. I'm sure that I took an interest in this, but whether I would have actually given up philosophy. You see, what I felt was I wanted to know more at the beginning of end of my life in the beginning, as I've always said. That philosophy was something in which I would just go on doing things. I wanted to accumulate something. I had a certain interest in knowing more about something. Reading and retaining. Reading and accumulating. I'm a natural accumulator. I don't like writing, but I rather like reading. And I like making notes. And I like learning. And you couldn't learn about philosophy. You could only examine and read articles and think of answers. And you could, so to speak, argue. But that was not my forte. My trouble was, whenever I went to the Philosophical Society, everything which everybody said seemed to be true. For and against. I mean, I... Always. Whenever anybody produced a good argument, I was convinced by it. As soon as somebody knocked it out, I was convinced by that. And if somebody knocked that out, I was convinced by that. At the end, I didn't know what I believed. Whereas in this case, I knew what I knew. You see, I mean, for example, I gave a broadcast about La Salle, which I enjoyed doing, because I read Life of La Salle, I knew about La Salle, connected with Marx. That was at least a contribution to something.
And despite your speech of yourself, of trying not to be strong on this side or the other side,
it was an attack. Yeah, I knew what I was against. I'm not quite sure what I was for. I knew what I was against. I knew what they were wrong about. And I knew what went in the wrong direction for me. I mean, I knew what I wanted to attack. That's why I got a reputation as a polemical writer. I was once described by my ex-pupil, Professor McKinnon, who is now ex-professor of theology in Cambridge, as an intellectual swashbuckler. I didn't like that very much, but I knew what he meant.
What's the expression?
Swashbuckler. That means a man who fights against everybody with a kind of sword. It means a man who's always fighting.
Yes.
It's not a true description. Like somebody comes to a room and immediately starts hitting out in all directions. No, it's not true. But I knew why he would have said it. Because I've always said violent onslaughts on. You see, look, take for example historical invisibility. Everybody was against it. I had no allies.
Really?
I mean, Catholics were against it. Because it was against doctrine. Well, Marxists, obviously. The Spectator conservatives were against it. Against tradition, against certain flow. Who? I had no allies. I mean, Popper was on the same side, but it didn't say anything. He's a very vain man. Would never praised anybody. Only himself. No, nobody. I don't think I ever received any praise or any friendly references. Nothing. Later, I just sort of vaguely referred to, but no. I remember when the lecture was up to disaster when I delivered it. That's for other reasons. The lecture itself was a great disaster. Yes. It was attacked by H. Carr. The first thing which happened. Then it was attacked by a man called Christopher Dawson, who was a Catholic ideologist. Exactly. He attacked it very violently. And then it was attacked in the Spectator by a man called, what is his name? A man who invented the idea of the establishment. He was a journalist. No, it's not. No, it's not. No, he didn't invent it. No, it's a man called Henry Fairley. Yes.
I like
well, he attacked me with considerable force. He's been in America now for 20 years. And he is a friend of Talmon. He won more than not so much as Atli. The real friend is Atli, who's now become a violent reaction. No, but now he writes these terrible articles in the Times. Let me see now. Who is in favor of it? Anybody. Same thing happened with two concepts of liberty, yes. No allies. I think the only people who were at all in favor was people like Irving Kristol and Encounter. That's for my, the only people who were at all favored. I mean, there's sort of rather conservative figures in that. Otherwise, I know nobody in Oxford, nobody in Cambridge. At that time, nobody.
See, on me it had a great impact.
Yes.
Very strong impact.
Yes.
And when you reviewed E.H. Carr's book, which was, in my opinion, a very important article.
In the Sunday Times. It was,
yes.
No, I never wrote in this.
I'm sure. This article is. It's the
big article. Doctor, I'll tell you two things. Wait. There are two separate things. The first volume of the history of the revolution was reviewed in news in the Sunday Times. You're talking about the listener. That's where we had a controversy. Because he published an attack on me.
You reviewed what is his book?
No, I didn't. He delivered a course of lectures, which became What is History,
yes.
Which were printed in the Listener.
Yes.
And that's what I attacked.
Yes. So
before it appeared as a book. Before it appeared as a book. These lectures were printed in the Listener.
Yes.
As lectures. Not Rees. No, they were not.
But I remember the lectures.
They were lectures that I was invited. The Levantine delivered instead. What? Wait a minute.
I read them in the Listener.
That's not what Carr delivered. Carr's lectures were called the Trevelyan lectures in Cambridge. And Trevelyan lectures in Cambridge. In them he attacked me.
Now
responded.
And I thought I still think that what you wrote in this short, concise article,
yes,
you should have developed into. I mean, after all, in your creed, your credo against the
institution,
is so important that all right. You wrote what you wrote in 51. I think that you ought to write another long article instead of only this short one, which was very persuasive, but being written in the Listener, not everybody...
No. Of course not.
I know that when I wrote this article, almost everybody tells me that they haven't read it.
No, of course not. Why should they? This one, you can ask in a loud voice, no reason why not. It's not appearing in print. E.H. Carr delivered lectures, which afterwards became a book called What is History? To which I replied.
In a very strong article, very concise.
He attacked me. He's a Listener. Well, his lectures were printed as articles. And I replied as a letter to the Listener. You see? Nothing to do with that. Not the lectures had nothing to do with this. They were on Russian thinkers. Yes, I must.
I know. We'll finish soon. Yes, all right.
I know.
So, we should start this historiography next time. So let's
finish. All right. Very good.
Now, in your
example, you suggested that you would do it. I thought that you had an experience, but I didn't.